Since it was interrupted by European capitalism and evolutionary process, the only way that Africa can unite today is through a revolutionary process aiming at a socialist economy. If capitalism destroyed us, it doesn't make sense to use capitalism to continue with it. We must use the antithesis of capitalism, which of course is socialism. And certainly if the evolutionary process has been interrupted, the only way we can capture the time lost is through a revolutionary process.
If in God we trust, then he must be green. Money makes the world go round, or so it seems. Why do Africans have American dreams? This whole world just revolves around material things. Hark, we heard the Harold Ames who sing, that money ain't a thing in heaven. What? Come on, money ain't a thing in heaven. What? You heard?
Now, you've done extensive research on this over the last several years. But you kind of give a Cliff Notes version at the top, and you give three points that kind of really crystallize your main argument around buying power. And I was wondering if you can discuss those.
Yeah, I did that just even recently because I was seeing that some of the arguments were getting lost in it. But basically, buying power is a marketing phrase that refers only to the power of consumers to purchase what are strictly available goods. It is not about economic strength. It is not about wealth. It is not about, you know, asset holdings, etc. It's strictly a marketing, a PR firm phrase to help corporations target their advertising to different segments of the buying population. The other point was that the claim that African America has roughly $1 trillion in buying power is an entirely phony myth, as I say, like unicorns, democracy, or freedom. And is it explained by looking behind some of the numbers that reports claim amassed to this $1 trillion? And we can talk about that in a moment, but those numbers just aren't real, is the real point I'm getting at. And then finally, and most importantly to me, is that the myth of buying power works to deny capitalism as a economic and social order, and it denies required inequality that comes with that. And it's used, the myth is used to blame poor people for being poor. And this idea that if we just consumed better, we wouldn't be poor. And it then, it, you know, paints this picture of just an ignorant, backwards, you know, impoverished group that is just, you know, woefully, you know, not taking advantage of all the freedom and equality that comes with the United
but
States.
But to that last point, yeah, with all the ongoing kind of issue of state violence, the new correlation is that if we just consume better, we wouldn't be killed.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, no, exactly.
This is ridiculous.
Right. I mean, and you know, Kwame Ture, you know, I added audio that is included in this post that where he just makes, you know, and I know he's doing it as an activist and an organizer, but you know, somewhat tongue in cheek, but he basically makes the point that if you want to end poverty, just give poor people money.
Right. With Voices with Vision, this is a show about revolutionary action. And so we do want to point to not just what economic power isn't, but what economic power is. And so one of the things that folks have been lifting up is the idea of banking black. And so we're going to speak with B. Doyle Mitchell Jr., who is the president and CEO of Industrial Bank. Everyone's been seeing those lists of black banks around the country that's been going around, and Industrial Bank is the DC's black bank. And so we're going to talk about that, and then we're going to go deeper into Dr. Ball, what you think economic power is. So let's I believe we have Mr. Mitchell on the phone. Mr. Mitchell, are you there?
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Now, we've got people listening from all over the world. Can you just give us a little background on the history of Industrial Bank?
Sure. The Industrial Bank was founded by my grandfather and eight other businessmen in 1934 at the height of the Great Depression, at 11th and U Street, Shaw neighborhood in Northwest Washington, D.C.
Black economics in this political moment where we're seeing increasing state violence and repression in black communities. And there's been many calls for people to buy black and bank black, calling for folks to go to Industrial Bank all on the same day, July 23rd at 9 a.m., this group HBCU Wall Street, to open accounts with Industrial. Have you seen an increase in new accounts as a result of this?
Yes, we have. The activity has been phenomenal. It's been exponentially greater than what we normally see on any given day or any given week. We're actually still counting the number of accounts. It's happening so fast and so much, which is a wonderful thing. We're trying to keep up with processing all this activity. So we have seen a lot of activity. We are totally grateful for it. That being said, let me just say this. This is what African Americans should be doing anyway. And there have been a number of efforts over the years that have called for African Americans to, you know, for blacks to support black businesses and support black banks. And we need to do it anyway. And if the shooting stops tomorrow, we need to keep this going. And here's the reason why. We have tremendous spending power, but it does us no good because we spend it outside of our community.
So can I, Mr. Mitchell, if I can chime in, and this is Netflix Freeman. So given that, so you said this is the reason, what you're outlining is the reason why we should continue to buy black and have our investments in black banks. I guess the implication is they will benefit us as a community. And so let's get to that direct benefit because, you know, if we look at the class disparities, I mean, I know a lot of people, they don't even have bank accounts, and not because they're being irresponsible, they just don't have the money for it. And so in what ways, more directly, are there interest-free loans that we could have, or is there grants that the banks and the businesses could make to projects that would have a long-term impact on the most affected, the most poverty-stricken people who really don't have anything to give into banks or anything like that, but that's really the crux of our oppression.
It's a good question. Let me explain. Maggie Anderson wrote a book in 2009 called Our Black Year. I suggest everybody get a copy of it. Every black person ought to have it in America, because what she and her husband did is say, I'm just buying black for an entire year. And they were amazingly successful. It was very difficult, and it required a lot of sacrifice. Sometimes she had to drive farther. Sometimes she had to pay a little more, but they did it. It's my black on black business Bible. So everybody should get that. Maggie Anderson, Our Black Year. She wrote this in 2009. In that book, they had Kellogg Business School that reduced to statistics a lot of data that we as African Americans and around this conversation need to be having all the time. So Kellogg Business School determined that we only spend 3% of our income with black businesses. And then what they determined is, what happens if we go from 3 to 10? Maggie's quote is 3 to 10, what you'll spend. If we only go to 10%, we create 1 million black jobs overnight.
So, but again, for me, the question, it goes back to this, what I'm calling the myth of black buying power. One, there isn't this amount of money that I think is often attached, this $1 trillion. It doesn't exist in the way that I think people think that it exists when they hear we have $1 trillion. There isn't a pot of $1 trillion that we just choose to spend foolishly. We buy what is available to us. And then, of course, these numbers are themselves questionable. So this notion of adjusting 10%, one, the question is, it's hard for, particularly for working people, working black people, to find black owned businesses that will satisfy their consumer needs, especially for regular day to day necessities.
And can I jump in? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
please,
I have to jump in.
Okay.
The trillion, 1.2, 1.3, the trillion is our GDP. It's our income.
That's incorrect. That's incorrect. That's not how those numbers are created. And that's part of what
How are they created?
They're created, well, if we look at the Selig Center, the way they came up with their numbers, they looked at a number of different factors, including, for instance, they judged the $1 trillion number would be based on black population growth, which was one of their saying that
that's
there would
not
be
true.
Well, I'm looking at their numbers. I mean, this is the Selig Center. You can just look at their research, and they posted, I'm quoting them, black population growth will lead to more black consumers, increased job opportunities that they predicted would be available to black people, which I think is extremely questionable when we start to look at black unemployment and then the disparity between.
Are they saying it's not total income among black Americans? If I
own, correct,
if I earn $100,000 and you earn $100,000 and it comes to $200,000, they're saying it's not our total income.
Correct. That's not how buying power is that term or that number is generated. It has nothing to do
with question their numbers.
Well, what I'm saying is having done research into this issue, I'm looking at how those numbers are generated, and I'm saying that the notion that we have $1 trillion in spending power is mythological. I can continue. Another one of their, they said that there's more education for Black America coming. So that would
so
mean,
for the purpose of this conversation, what do so, African Americans not have a lot of income?
Correct. I'm saying that Black Americans do not have, correct. I'm saying that Black Americans do not have this tremendous amount of income that can be spent in any way that Black people want. A lot of what Black people and all working people do is they spend on what is available to them, and they spend based a lot of it on credit. It's not even based on income, because wages have remained flat since the 70s, and the way that the corporate capitalist world has adjusted for that is to offer more loans through credit card debt. So that's why you have the average Black household has about $7,000 in credit card debt, which puts them just about $4,000 less than what the median net household worth of a Black family is, which is, I think, just about $11,000. So there is not this pot of money that's being spent that would generate this kind of buying
money,
power.
But there's a lot of money that goes
the
through
other
our
part
hands.
Of it.
That's the point.
No, but the other part of that, to this point you're raising about going through the hands, is that there aren't the amount of Black businesses that can accommodate Black consumer needs, number one. And then the other part of it is that the historical research says much to the opposite, much like the research that Earl O'Fari Hutchinson did back in the 60s, since the 60s, showing that there is no correlation between an increase in Black business and Black even banks and the collective uplift of Black people. So we may create Black wealthy individual,
so,
but
so
we're
what
not
you're saying is we're poor,
for
and all of this is not going to help, and so therefore we should not try it. Is that what I'm hearing?
I'm not saying not to try it. I'm saying that it's not an answer to the problem that is created by capitalism and primarily by capitalism and its impact on working people. In this case, particularly Black working people.
So I can definitely tell you that if we redirect our income to Black businesses, and it does take time and effort to find them and help grow them. It's not an easy solution. It doesn't happen overnight. But they are out there, and the more efforts we use to support them, find them, support them, and help them to grow, will make a difference in our community. But we're using this as an excuse as to someone who makes $35,000 or $50,000 not to even try to find Black businesses or not to even open up an account at a Black bank.
No, I'm
bank.
Saying don't blame them, because if you're only making $35,000, which is the average salary of a working person across races, so it's lower for Black people, actually, and we're talking about communities that are spending upwards of 70, in some cases 90% of their income just on housing. There isn't this, and there isn't leftover money for buying a lot of different things and supporting a lot of different businesses. So that's part of it.
Well, all right. So, JB, we got you on the line?
Yes, indeed.
Brother, so that was a blast. So I know you've been doing a lot of interviews already about the new book. Now, since that interview, that was in 2006, July 2006, I'm sure you remember it well. It was very interesting, and it went on. We just couldn't play it. We needed to give you the live time. But since then, you've been able to put into a book, taking all the information and research and your book, The Myth and Propaganda of Black Buying Power. That was a very revealing conversation we had there. Since then, I guess we want to start with, and we also have my co-host Brother Craig on. Is there anything, maybe your initial thoughts on rehearing that? And then also, is there anything that you've learned or researched more that adds to what we knew then and what you knew then?
First of all, thanks again for having me and for having me on. Although I feel a little set up having to follow what was really an amazing interview in the first half of your show, so I'm a little saddened to be part of what is an apparent cutting off of that conversation.
No, it's good.
I was just messing with you. But it was a great conversation. It was a great interview, and he didn't have that much time.
He had to go.
No, I know. I'm just playing. I know it's not that. But just specifically to your question, yes, first of all, I wrote about that interview in the book, so it's discussed in the book some detail, because even as it was happening, I knew I was going to write about it because I thought that the exchange was so revealing. And really the only polite thing I can say publicly about that conversation is that in that moment, Mr. Mitchell showed zero signs that he has any understanding of how the economy works, the relationship black people have to it, or the relationship banks have to it. And that, I think, is unfortunate, given that he is a black man and the head of a black-owned bank. So I just found that to be disturbing. So, yeah, I have learned a lot since then, and I do write about it in the book.
Hello? Breaking up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe this is a little better. What I've learned is that one of the issues that was made clear in that exchange, and that I've learned a lot about since that exchange, is that the myth of buying power has, it to a much greater extent than I knew at the time, been evolved largely as a result of that class, of that black business commercial class, particularly the business and media class, that wanted to evolve the myth to promote an unreality to white corporate advertisers, corporate ad buyers, to cajole or to convince them to spend money with the black press. So to do that, they helped in the post-Second World War era, led largely by John H. Johnson, to produce this mythology that black people were doing better than we actually are. And that has helped to propel the myth that you see carried even through that conversation, where there's no discussion of the numbers, there's no suggestion or evidence that those who promote the myth are even reading the research or understand the history of the concept, or even where the numbers come from. So, and just very quickly, what that conversation showed, and that I do discuss in the book in some detail, is that the myth in its modern origin, it has a government and business 19th century history, but in its current form was developed by the black commercial and business press and class in league with the U.S. government and the Chamber of Commerce to literally link buying power to black income. And that has always been a misunderstanding and a falsehood that has been exacerbated, and even you just heard it right there. So this idea that our income should be spent in its entirety to suggest some sort of collective power is absurd. But then the numbers themselves just are not real. We don't earn more than $1 trillion a year collectively. I think it's barely $800 billion at this point. It's going to be much less after this crisis. But then to suggest that there's an actual power behind spending everything a group earns, largely in areas on companies and entities that black people cannot own, is simply absurd.
Right. And now let me add, one, I got to make a point of correction. I think someone told me I said 2006, but it was 2016. That we had that interview. Now, since, and I don't remember, I don't think this came up in our interview, but since then I have heard you talk about the fact that some of us on the left, there's a history of some of us on the left getting that wrong and read it. If you can talk about some of that, and also let's not forget to get in the launch party and the information people need to know about that.
Well, I'll just quickly start there. I mixwhatilike.org, and people can get everything they need. The links to purchase the book, the links to get access to the virtual book party, all of that kind of stuff is at mixwhatilike.org. But what I do discuss a little bit in the book and have tried to over the years to point out is that one of the reasons that the myth has such a power behind it is that it has been misunderstood by the entire black political spectrum, in part because in its current modern form over the last 50, 60 years, it's been propelled and even developed. And this is something that I didn't know as much before I got into the book process myself. It has been evolved in partnership by the black commercial press. So the myth is literally developed and then promoted by the black press, and described in a way and couched in a language, obviously, that suits and fits well with our communities and permeates throughout the political spectrum. So historically, this was one of the, what I thought was very interesting, one of the points of agreement between Du Bois and Garvey, that both agreed that there was a buying power that we could just better make better use of. Now, my point in the book, and I try to, you know, one of the points I can't really draw out enough in the book is that there are different ways people try to apply it, and organizations have tried to apply it. And I'm not suggesting that Garvey and Du Bois and Booker T. Washington are all the same, and I'm not suggesting that they are all to be compared with a black commercial press or a black commercial capitalist elite. But they have all misunderstood this concept and look to apply it in their various organizational efforts. So it's been run by those three that I mentioned. It's been picked up, of course, by Malcolm X and Minister Farrakhan today, Claude Anderson, and Amos Wilson historically was one of the biggest, unfortunately, purveyors of the myth. But in his attempt to address and to help his community, he and others have just misunderstood this. So, but because nobody has actually, and he was actually, Wilson, as I talk about in the book, was one of the first to actually pull from what I'm calling the myth's modern purveyors, the Selig Center, in 1994-95, where which I talk is another turning point in the propulsion of the myth. But Wilson, in his dogged research and attempt to help everybody, help African people, was on trying to be on top of the economic condition. But I think misread what these reports are. They're marketing reports meant to help wed mm-hmm. corporations with ad buyers. They're not. It's not meant to assess economic condition or what an actual strength is or what actual money we even have.
Yeah. Okay, just this last question. Could you just describe a little bit more about the launch party, because it's a virtual thing? So what can people expect? And I know I didn't want to cut. Go ahead. Yeah, you don't have them.
Well, just sure. I mean, with the Get It, we have a lot of great things lined up. We have conversations. We have interviews with some experts and people talking about the book and various aspects of the book. We have some musical performances. We have and a chance, of course, for people to raise questions and critiques and to engage with me and with us, and it's going to be, I think, a great time. And I think, you know, a virtual book launch is as good as we could do in this moment. So again, I mixwhatilike.org, and everybody can get everything that they need for all of this.
Okay, brother, thank you so much for doing this. We got to make way. Well, I wish we had more time. Brother Craig, you still there? Anyway, check us out on iTunes, Google Play Music, all that stuff. And if you're not fighting for the liberation of your people, fall back.
F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people. F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K.